Suicides of Sitka. It is also, by custom and charter, the home of the Einstein Chess Club. A member of the Einstein Chess Club, named Melech Geistik, won the world championship title over the Dutchman Jan Timman at St. Petersburg in 1980. The World's Fair fresh in their memory. Sitkanics viewed Geistik's triumph as further proof of their merit and identity as a people. Geistik was subject to fits of rage, black moods, and bouts of incoherence, but these flaws were overlooked in the general celebration. One fruit of Geistik's victory was the gift of the hotel ballroom by the Einstein management, free of rent, to the chess club. Hotel weddings were out of vogue, and management had been trying for years to clear the Potzers, with their mutterings and smoke, from the coffee shop. Geistik provided management the excuse they needed. They sealed off the main doors of the ballroom so that you could enter only through the back, off an alley. They pulled up the fine ashwood parquetry and laid down a demented checkerboard of linoleum in shades of soot, bile, and surgical scrub green. The modernist chandelier was replaced by banks of fluorescent tubes bolted to the high concrete ceiling. 2 months later, the young world champion wandered into the old coffee shop, where Lanzmann's father had once made his mark, sat down in a booth at the back, took out a Colt 38 detective special, and shot himself in the mouth. There was a note in his pocket. It said only, "I like things better the way they were before." "Emmanuel Esker," the Russian says to the two detectives, looking up from the chessboard under an old neon clock that advertises the defunct newspaper, The Blatt. He is a skeletal man, his skin thin, pink, and peeling. He wears a pointed black beard. His eyes are close-set and the color of cold seawater. "Emmanuel Esker." The Russian's shoulders hunch, and he ducks his head, and his ribcage swells and narrows. It looks like laughter, but no sound comes out. "I wish that he does come around here." Like that of most Russian immigrants, the man's Yiddish is experimental and brusque. He reminds Lanzmann of somebody, though Lanzmann can't say whom. "I give him such a kick to his ass for him." "You ever look at his games?" the Russian's opponent wants to know. He is a young man with pudding cheeks and rimless glasses and a complexion tinged with green like the white of a dollar bill. The lenses of his glasses ice over as he aims them at Lanzmann. "You ever look at his games, detective?" "Just to make this clear," Lanzmann says, "that isn't the Lasker we have in mind." "The man was only using the name as an alias," Berko says. "Otherwise we'd be looking for a man who's already been dead 60 years. "You look at Lasker's games today," the young man continues. "There's too much complexity. He makes everything too hard." "Only it seems complexity to you, Velvel," says the Russian, "for the reason of how much you are simple." The Shamuses have interrupted their game in its dense middle stages, with the Russian playing white, holding an unassailable night outpost. The men are still caught up in their game, the way a pair of mountains get caught up in a whiteout. Their natural impulse is to treat the detectives with the abstract contempt they reserve for all kibitzers. Lanzmann wonders if he and Berko ought to wait until the players have finished and then try again. But there are other games in progress, other players to question. Around the old ballroom, legs scratch the linoleum like fingernails on a chalkboard. Chessmen click like the cylinder turning in Melech Geistik's 38. The men, there are no women here, play by means of steadily hectoring their opponents with self-aspersions, chilly laughter, whistling, harumphs. "As long as we're making things clear," Berko says. "This man who called himself Emmanuel Lasker, but was not the noted world champion born in Prussia in 1868, has died, and we are investigating that death. In our capacity as homicide detectives, which we mention, but without, it seems, making much of an impression." "A Jew with blonde hair," the Russian says. "And freckles," Velvel says. "You see," the Russian says, "we pay close attention." He snatches up one of his rooks the way you pluck at a stray hair on somebody's collar. Together his fingers and the rook take their trip down the file and break the bad news to the black's remaining bishop with a tap. Velvel speaks Russian now, with a Yiddish accent, offering his wishes for the resumption of friendly relations between his opponent's mother and a well-endowed stallion. "I am orphan," the Russian says. He sits back in his chair as if expecting his opponent to require some time to recover from the loss of his bishop. He knots his arms around his chest and jams his hands into his armpits. It is the gesture of a man who wants to smoke a papyrus in a room where the habit has been forbidden. Lanzmann wonders what his father would have done with himself if the Einstein Chess Club had banned smoking while he was alive. The man could go through a whole pack of Broadways in a single game. "Blonde," the Russian says, the very soul of helpfulness. "Freckles. What else, please?" Lantzman shuffles through his scanty hand of details, trying to decide which one to play. A student of the game, we're guessing. Up on his chess history. He had a book by Siegbert Tarrasch in his room. And then there's the alias he was using. So astute, the Russian says without bothering to sound sincere. A couple of top-dollar shamuses. The remark does not so much rankle Lantzman as nudge him half a wisecrack closer to remembering this bony Russian with a peeling skin. At one time, possibly, he continues more slowly, groping for the memory, watching the Russian, the deceased was a pious Jew, a black hat. The Russian tugs his hands out from under his arms. He sits forward in his chair. The ice on his Baltic eyes seems to thaw all at once. He was a smack addict? His tone barely qualifies as a question, and when Lantzman doesn't immediately deny the charge, he says, Frank. He pronounces the name American style with a long, sharp vowel and a shadowless R. Ah, no. Frank, Velville agrees. The Russian slumps, knees spread, hands dangling at his sides. Detectives, can I tell you one thing, he says. Truly, sometimes I hate this lamentable excuse for a world. Tell us about Frank, Berko says. You liked him. The Russian hoists his shoulders, his eyes iced over again. I do not like anyone, he says. But when Frank comes in here, at least I do not run screaming out the door. He's funny. Not handsome man, but handsome voice. Serious voice, like the man who plays serious music on the radio. At 3 o'clock in the morning, you know, talking about Shostakovich. He says things in serious voice. It's funny. Everything he says, always it's a little bit criticism. Cut of your hair, how ugly your pants, how Velva jumps every time a person mentions his wife. True enough, Velva says. I do. Always teasing you, but I don't know why, it don't piss you off. He felt like he was harder on himself, Velva says. When you play him, even though he wins every time, you feel you play better against him than with the assholes in this club, the Russian says. Frank is never asshole. Meyer, says Berko, soft. He flies the flags of his eyebrows in the direction of the next table. They have an audience. Lantzman turns. The two men confront each other over a game in its early stages. One wears the modern jacket and pants and full beard of a Lubavitcher Jew. His beard is dense and black, as if shaded in with a soft pencil. A steady hand has pinned a black velour skullcap trimmed with black silk to the black tangle of his hair. His navy overcoat and blue fedora hang from a hook set into the mirrored wall behind him. The lining of his coat and the label of his hat are reflected in the glass. Exhaustion stains the underlids of his eyes. Fervent eyes, bovine and sad. His opponent is a bobover in a long robe, breeches, white hose, and slippers. His skin is as pale as a page of commentary. His hat perches on his lap, a black cake on a black dish. His skull cap lies flat as a sewn pocket against the back of his cropped head. To the eye not disillusioned by police work, they might appear to be as lost as any pair of Einstein Potzers in the diffused radiance of their game. Lantzman would be willing to bet $100, however, that neither of them even knows whose move it is. They have been listening to every word at the neighboring table. They are listening now. Berko walks over to the table on the other side of the Russian and Velville. It's unoccupied. He picks up a bentwood chair with a ripped cane seat and swings it around to a spot between the table of the black hats and the table where the Russian is breaking Velville down. He sits down in that grand fat man way he has, spreading his legs, tossing the flaps of his overcoat behind him, as if he is going to make a fine meal of them all. He takes off his own Homburg, palming it by the crown. His Indian hair stands thick and lustrous, threaded lately with silver. Gray hair makes Berko look wiser and kinder. An effect that, though he is relatively wise and fairly kind, he will not hesitate to abuse. The bentwood chair grows alarmed at the scope and contour of Berko's buttocks. Hi, Berko says to the black hats. He rubs his palms together, then spreads them across his thighs. All the man needs is a napkin to tuck into his collar, a fork and a knife. How are you? With the art and determination of the very worst actors, the black hats look up, surprised. We don't want any trouble, the Lubavitcher says. My favorite phrase in the Yiddish language, Berko says sincerely. Now, how about we get you in on this discussion? Tell us about Frank. We do not know him, the Lubavitcher says. Frank who? The Bobover says nothing. Friend Bobover, Lantzman says gently. Your name. "My name is Saltiel Lapidus," the Babava says. His eyes are girlish and shy. He folds his fingers in his lap on top of his hat. "And I know nothing about anything."
"You played with this Frank? You knew him?"
Saltiel Lapidus gives his head a hasty shake.
"No."
"Yes," the Lubavitcher says. "He was known to us."
Lapidus glares at his friend, and the Lubavitcher looks away.
Lanzmann reads the story. Chess is permitted to the pious Jew, even alone among games, on the Sabbath. But the Einstein Chess Club is a resolutely secular institution. The Lubavitcher dragged the Babaver into this profane temple on a Friday morning with Sabbath coming, and both of them having better things to do. He said everything would be fine, what harm could come of it? And now see. Lanzmann is curious, even touched. A friendship across sectarian lines is not a common phenomena in his experience. In the past, it has struck him that apart from homosexuals, only chess players have found the reliable way to bridge, intensely but without fatal violence, the gulf that separates any given pair of men. "I have seen him here," the Lubavitcher declares, his eye on his friend, as if to show him they have nothing to fear. "This so-called Frank, maybe I played him one or two times. In my opinion, he was a highly talented player."
"Compared to you, Fishkin," the Russian says, "a monkey is a Raoul Capablanca."
"You," Lanzmann says to the Russian, his voice level, playing a hunch. "You knew he was a heroin addict."
"How?"
"Detective Lanzmann," the Russian says, half reproachful.
"You do not recognize me?"
It felt like a hunch, but it was only a mislaid memory.
"Vasily Shitnovitzer," Lanzmann says.
It has not been so long, a dozen years, since he arrested a young Russian of that name for conspiracy to sell heroin. A recent immigrant, a former convict, swept clear of the chaos that followed the collapse of the Third Russian Republic. A man with broken Yiddish, this heroin dealer, and pale eyes set too close together.
"And you knew me all this time."
"You are handsome fellow, hard to forget," Shitnovitzer says. "Also snappy dresser."
Shitnovitzer spent a long time in Butyrka, Lanzmann tells Berko, meaning the notorious Moscow prison.
"Nice guy. Used to sell junk from the kitchen of the coffee shop here."
"You sold heroin to Frank?" Berko says to Shitnovitzer.
"I am retired," Vasily Shitnovitzer says, shaking his head. 64 federal months in Ellensburg, Washington. Worse than Butyrka. Never again I don't touch that stuff, detectives. And even if I do, believe me, I don't go near Frank. I am crazy, but I am not lunatic."
Lanzmann feels the bump and the skid as the tires lock. They have just hit something.
"Why not?" Berko says, kindly and wise. "Why does selling smack to Frank make you not just a criminal but a lunatic, Mr. Shitnovitzer?"
There is a small decisive clink, a bit hollow, like false teeth clapping together. Velville tips over his king.
"I resign," says Velville. He takes off his glasses, slips them into his pocket, and stands up. "He forgot an appointment. He's late for work. His mother is calling him on the ultrasonic frequency reserved by the government for Jewish mothers in the event of lunch."
"Sit down," Berko says without turning around.
The kid sits down. A cramp has seized Chitnovich's intestines. That's how it looks to Lanzmann.
"Bad mazel," he says finally.
"Bad mazel," Lanzmann repeats, letting his doubt and his disappointment show.
"Like a coat, a hat of bad mazel on his head. So much bad mazel you don't want to touch him or to share oxygen nearby."
"I saw him playing 5 games at once," Belville offers. "For $100. He won them all. Then I saw him vomiting in the alley."
"Detectives, please," Saltiel Lapidus says in a pained voice. "We have nothing to do with this. We know nothing about this man. Heroin, vomiting in alleys. Please, we're already uncomfortable enough."
"Embarrassed," the Lubavitcher suggests.
"Sorry," Lapidus concludes.
"And we have nothing to say. So please, may we go?"
"Sure thing," Berko says. "Take off. Just write down your names and contact information for us before you go."
He takes out his so-called notebook, a small, fat sheaf of paper held together with an extra-large paperclip. At any given moment, it might be found to contain business cards, tides tables, to-do lists, chronological listings of English kings, theories scrawled at 3 a.m, $5 bills, jotted recipes, folded cocktail napkins with the layout of a South Sitka alley in which a hooker was killed. He shuffles through his notebook until he arrives at a blank scrap of index card, which he hands to Fishkin the Lubavitcher. He holds out his stub of pencil, but no thank you, Fishkin has a pen of his own. He writes down his name and address and the number of his chauffeur, then passes it to Lapidus, who does the same.
Only, Fishkin says, don't call us. Don't come to our homes. I beg you, we don't have anything to say. There's nothing about that Jew that we can tell you. Every Naz in the district learns to respect the silence of the Black Hat. It is a refusal to answer that can spread and gather and deepen until, like a fog, it fills the street of an entire Black Hat neighborhood. Black Hats wield skillful attorneys and political clout and boisterous newspapers, and can enfold a hapless inspector or even a commissioner in a great black-hatted stink that doesn't go away until the witness or suspect is kicked loose or the charges are dropped. Lanzmann would need the full weight of the department behind him, and at the very least his skipper's approval, before he could invite Lapidus and Fishkin into the hot box of the homicide modular. He risks a glance at Berko, who risks a slight shake of the head. Go, Lanzmann says. Lapidus lurches to his feet like a man defeated by his bowels. The business of coat and galoshes is undertaken with a show of battered dignity. He returns the iron lid of his hat by half inches to his head, the way you ease down a manhole cover. With a grieving eye, he watches Fishkin sweep his unplayed mourning into a hinged wooden box. Side by side, the Black Hats conduct themselves among the tables, past the other players, who look at them go. Just before they reach the doors, the left leg of Saltiel Lapidus comes unstrung at its tuning key. He sags, gives way, and reaches to steady himself with a hand on the shoulder of his friend. The floor under his feet is bare and smooth. As far as Lanzmann can tell, there is nothing to catch the toe. I never saw such a sad Babavar, he observes. Jew is on the verge of tears.
You want to push him again?
Just an inch or two.
That's all you get with them anyway, Berko says.
This ends Disc 2. The Yiddish Policeman's Union, Disc 3.
They hurry past the Potzers, a seedy violinist from the Sitka Odeon, a chiropodist, you see his picture on bus benches. Berko bursts through the doors after Lapidus and Fishkin. Lanzmann is about to follow when something wistful tugs at his memory, a whiff of some brand of aftershave that nobody wears anymore. The jangling chorus of a song that was moderately popular one August 25 summers ago. Lanzmann turns to the table nearest the door. An old man sits clenched like a fist around the chessboard, facing an empty chair. He has the pieces set up in their opening squares and has drawn or assigned himself white, waiting for his opponent to show. Shining skull edged with tufts of grayish hair like pocket lint, the lower part of his face hidden by the cant of his head. Visible to Lanzmann are the hollows of his temples, his halo of dandruff, the bony bridge of his nose, the grooves on his brow like a grid left in raw pie crust by the tines of a fork, and the furious hunch of his shoulders, gripping the problem of the chessboard, planning his brilliant campaign. They were broad shoulders at one time, the shoulders of a hero or a mover of pianos.
Mr. Litvak, Lanzmann says.
Litvak selects his king's knight the way a painter chooses a brush. His hands remain agile and ropey. He daubs an arching stroke toward the center of the board. He always favored the hypermodern style of play. At the sight of the ratey opening and Litvak's hands, Lanzmann is flooded, almost knocked down by the old dread of chess, by the tedium, the irritation, the shame of those days spent breaking his father's heart over the chessboards in the Einstein coffee shop. He says louder, Alter Litvak. Litvak looks up, puzzled and myopic. He was a man for a fistfight, barrel-chested, a hunter, a fisherman, a soldier. When he reached for a chessman, you saw the flash of the lightning bolt on his big gold army ranger ring. Now he looks shrunken, depleted, the king in the story reduced by the curse of eternal life to a cricket in the ashes of the hearth. Only the vaulting nose remains as testament to the former grandeur of his face. Looking at the wreckage of the man, Lanzmann thinks that if his father had not taken his own life, he would in all likelihood be dead nevertheless. Litvak makes an impatient or petitioning gesture with his hand. He takes from his breast pocket a marbled black notepad and a fat fountain pen. He wears his beard neatly trimmed as ever. A houndstooth blazer, tasseled boat shoes, a display handkerchief, a scarf strung through his lapels. The man has not lost his sporting air. In the pleats of his throat is a shining scar, a whitish comma tinged with pink. As he writes in the pad with his big waterman, Litvak's breath comes through his great fleshy nose in patient gusts. The scratch of the nib is all that remains to him for a voice. He passes the pad to Lanzmann. His script is steady and clear.
Do I know you?
His gaze sharpens, and he cocks his head to one side, sizing Lanzmann up, reading the wrinkled suit, the pork pie hat, the face like Herschel the dog's, knowing Lanzmann without recognizing him. He takes back the pad and appends one word to his question.
Do I know you, detective?
Meyer Lanzmann, Lanzmann says, handing the old man a business card.
You knew my father. I used to come here with him from time to time, back when the club was in the coffee shop.
The red-rimmed eyes widen. Wonder mingles with horror as Mr. Litvak intensifies his study of Lanzmann, searching for some proof of this unlikely claim. He turns a page in his pad and pronounces his findings in the matter.
Impossible. No way Meyer Le Lanzmann could be such a lumpy old sack of onions.
Afraid so, Lanzmann says.
What are you doing here, terrible chess player?
I was only a kid, Lanzmann says, horrified to detect a creak of self-pity in his tone. What an awful place. What wretched men. What a cruel and pointless game. Mr. Litvak, you don't happen to know a man. I gather he plays here sometimes. A Jew, maybe they call him Frank.
Yes, I know him. Has he done something wrong?
How well do you know him?
Not as well as I would like.
Do you know where he lives, Mr. Litvak? Have you seen him recently?
Months. Please say you are not a homicide detective.
Again, Lanzmann says, I'm afraid so. The old man blinks. If he is shocked or saddened by the inference, you can't read it anywhere in his face or body language. But then a man not in control of his emotions would never get very far with their ready opening. Maybe there is a hint of shakiness in the word he writes next in his pad.
Overdose?
Gunshot, Lanzmann says. The door to the club creaks open, and a couple of potsers come in from the alley looking gray and cold. A gaunt scarecrow barely out of his teens, with a trimmed golden beard in a suit that's too small for him, and a short, chubby man, dark and curly-bearded, in a suit that's much too large. Their crew cuts look patchy, as if self-inflicted, and they wear matching black crocheted yarmulkes. They hesitate a moment in the doorway, abashed, looking at Mr. Litvak as if they expect to be scolded. The old man speaks then, inhaling the words, his voice a dinosaurian ghost. It's an awful sound, a malfunction of the windpipe. A moment after it fades, Lanzmann realizes that he said,
"My grandnephews."
Litvak waves them in and passes Lanzmann's card to the chubby one.
"Nice to meet you, detective," the chubby one says with a hint of an accent, maybe Australian.
He takes the empty chair, glances at the board, and smartly brings out his own king's knight.
"Sorry, Uncle Alder. That one was late, as usual."
The skinny one hangs back with his hand on the open door of the club.
"Lanzmann," Berko calls from the alley, where he has Fishkin and Lapidus corralled beside the dumpster. It appears to Lanzmann that Lapidus is bawling like a child.
"What the hell?"
"Right there,"
Lanzmann says.
"I have to go, Mr. Litvak."
For an instant, he handles the bones, horn, and leather of the old man's hand. "Where can I reach you if I need to talk to you some more?" Litvak writes out an address and tears the leaf from his pad.
"Madagascar," Lanzmann says, reading the name of some unimaginable street in Tananarive. "That's a new one."
At the sight of that faraway address, at the thought of that house on Rue Jean Bar, Lanzmann feels a profound ebb in his will to pursue the matter of the dead Yid in 208. What difference will it make if he catches the killer? A year from now, Jews will be Africans, and this old ballroom will be filled with tea-dancing Gentiles, and every case that ever was opened or closed by a Sitka policeman will have been filed in Cabinet 9.
"When are you leaving?"
"Next week," says the chubby great-nephew, sounding doubtful.
The old man emits another horrible reptilian croak, one that nobody understands. He writes, then slides the notepad across to his great-nephew.
"Man makes plans," the kid reads, "and God laughs."
11. Sometimes when the younger black hats are caught by the police, they turn haughty and angry and demand their rights as American subjects, and sometimes they break down and cry. Men tend to cry, in Lanzmann's experience, when they have been living for a long time with a sense of rightness and safety, and then they realize that all along, just under their boots, lay the abyss. That is part of the policeman's job, to jerk back the pretty carpet that covers over the deep, jagged hole in the floor. Lanzmann wonders if that's how it is with Saltiel Lapidus. Tears stream down his cheeks. A glinting thread of mucus dangles from his right nostril.
Mr. Lapidus is feeling a little sad, Berko says, but he won't say why.
Lonsman feels around in the pocket of his overcoat for a package of Kleenex and finds one miraculous sheet. Lapidus hesitates, then takes it and blows his nose with feeling.
I swear to you, I didn't know the man, Lapidus says. I don't know where he lived, who he was. I don't know anything. I swear on my life, we played chess a few times. He always won.
You're just grieving for the sake of humanity, then, Lonsman says, trying to keep the sarcasm out of his tone.
Exactly right, Lapidus says.
And then he balls the tissue in his fist and tosses that crumpled flower into the gutter.
Are you going to take us in? Fishkin demands. Because if you are, then I want to call a lawyer, and if you're not, then you have to let us go.
A black hat lawyer, Berko says, and it's a kind of moan or plea directed toward Lonsman. Woe is me.
Get going, then, Lonsman says. Berko gives them a nod. The two men crunch off through the filthy slush of the alley.
So no, I'm irritated, Berko says. I admit this one is starting to irritate me.
Lonsman nods and scratches at the stubble of his chin in a way that is meant to signify deep ratiocination, but his heart and thoughts are hung up in the memory of chess games that he lost to men who were already old 30 years ago.
Did you see that old guy in there, he says, by the door?
Alter Litvak. Been hanging around the Einstein for years. Used to play my father. Your father, too.
I've heard the name.
Berko looks back at the steel fire door that is the Einstein Club's grand entrance.
War hero. Cuba.
The man has no voice. He has to write everything down. I asked him where I could find him if I needed to talk to him, and he wrote that he was going to Madagascar.
That's a new one.
That's what I said.
Did he know our Frank?
Not well, he said.
Nobody knew our Frank, Berko says, but everybody is very sad that he died.
He buttons his coat over his belly, turns up his collar, settles his hat more firmly on his head.
Even you.
Fuck you, Lonsman says. The Yid was nothing to me.
Maybe he was a Russian. That might explain the chess. And your pal Vasily's behavior. Maybe Lebert or Moskowitz is behind the hit.
If he's Russian, it doesn't explain what the two black hats were so afraid of, Lonsman says. Those two don't know from Moskowitz. Russian Stark is a gangland hit. It just doesn't mean that much to your average Bobova. He gives his chin another few pulls and then makes up his mind. He looks up at the strip of radiant gray sky that stretches along the top of the narrow alley behind the Hotel Einstein. I wonder what time sunset is tonight.
Why, we're going to poke a stick into the Harkavy Mire? I don't think Bina will care much for that. We start stirring up the black hats down there.
You don't, eh? Lonsman smiles. He takes the valet ticket from his pocket. Then we better steer clear of the Harkavy.
Uh-oh. You have that smile.
You don't like the smile?
Only I've noticed what comes after is usually a question that you plan to answer yourself.
How about this one? What kind of a Yid, Berko? Tell me this. What kind of a Yid can make a prison-hard Russian sociopath want to crap in his pants and bring tears to the eyes of the most pious black hat in Sitka?
I know you want me to say a Verbover, Berko says.
After Berko passed out of the academy, his first billet was the 5th Precinct, the Harkavy, where the Verbovers landed, along with most of their fellow black hats, after the 1948 arrival of the 9th Verbover Rebbe, father-in-law of the present model, with the pitiful remnant of his court. It was a classic ghetto assignment, trying to help and protect people who disdain and despise you and the authority you represent. It ended when the young half-Indian Latke took a bullet in the shoulder, 2 inches from his heart, in the Shavuos massacre at Goldblatt's Dairy Restaurant.
I know that's who you want me to say.
This is how Berko once explained to Lonsman the sacred gang known as the Chassids of Verbov. They started out back in the Ukraine, black hats like all the other black hats, scorning and keeping their distance from the trash and hoo-ha of the secular world, inside their imaginary ghetto wall of ritual and faith. Then the entire sect was burned in the fires of the destruction, down to a hard, dense core of something blacker than any hat. What was left of the 9th Verbover Rebbe emerged from those fires with 11 disciples and, among his family, only the 6th of his 8 daughters. He rose into the air like a charred scrap of paper and blew to this narrow strip between the barren of mountains and the end of the world. And here he found a way to remake the old-style black hat detachment. He carried its logic to its logical end, the way evil geniuses do in cheap novels. He built a criminal empire that profited on the meaningless tohubahu beyond the theoretical walls, on beings so flawed, corrupted, and hopeless of redemption, that only cosmic courtesy led the Verbivers even to consider them human at all.
I had the same thought, of course, Berko confesses, which I immediately suppressed. He claps his big hands over his face and leaves them there for a moment before dragging them slowly down, pulling at his cheeks until they stretch past his chin like the jowl flaps of a bulldog.
Woe is me, Meyer. You want us to go out to Verbov Island?
Fuck no, Lantzman says, an American. Truth, Berko, I hate that place. If we have to go to an island, I'd much rather go to Madagascar. They stand there in the alley behind the Einstein, thinking through the numerous arguments against and the few that can be made in favor of pissing off the most powerful underworld characters north of the 55th parallel. They attempt to generate alternate explanations for the squirrely behavior of the Potzers and the Einstein.
We'd better see Itzig Zimbalist, Berko says finally. Anybody else out there, it's going to be as useful as talking to a dog, and a dog already broke my heart once today.
12. The street grid here on the island is still Sitka's, ruled and numbered, but apart from that, you are gone, sweetness. Starshot, teleported, spun clear through the wormhole to the planet of the Jews. Friday afternoon on Verbov Island, and Lanceman Chevelle Supersport surfs the wave of black hats along Avenue 225. The hats in question are felt numbers, with high dented crowns and mile-wide brims, the kind favored by overseers in plantation melodramas. The women sport headscarves and glossy wigs spun from the hair of the poor Jewesses of Morocco and Mesopotamia. Their coats and long dresses are the finest rags of Paris and New York. Their shoes, the flower of Italy. Boys careen down the sidewalks on inline roller skates in a slipstream of scarves and sidelocks, flashing the orange linings of their unzipped parkas. Girls, hobbled by long skirts, go along braided arm in arm. Raucous chains of Verbiver girls vehement and clannish as schools of philosophy. The sky has turned steely, the wind has died, and the air crackles with the alchemy of children and the promise of snow.
Look at this place, Lanceman says. It's hopping.
Not one empty storefront.
And more of these no-good yids than ever.
Lanceman stops for a red at Northwest 28th Street. Outside a corner store by a study hall, Torah bachelors loiter, scripture grifters, unmatchable Luftmenches, and garden-variety hoodlums. When they notice Lanceman's car with its reek of plainclothesman hubris and its inflammatory double S on the grill, they leave off yelling at one another and give Lanceman the Bessarabian fisheye. He is on their turf. He goes clean-shaven and does not tremble before God. He is not a verb of a Jew, and therefore is not really a Jew at all. And if he is not a Jew, then he is nothing.
Look at those assholes looking, Lanceman says. I don't like it.
Meyer.
The truth is, black hat Jews make Lanceman angry, and they always have. He finds that it is a pleasurable anger, rich with layers of envy, condescension, resentment, and pity. He puts the car in gear and shoves open his door.
Meyer, no!
Lanceman steps around the open door of the Supersport. He feels the women watching. He smells the sudden fear on the breath of the men around him, like caries of the teeth. He hears the laughter of the chickens that have not yet met their fates, the hum of the air compressors keeping the carp alive in their tanks. He's glowing like a needle that you heat to kill a tick.
So new, he says to the yids on the corner. Which one of you buffaloes wants a ride in my sweet Nazmobile?
A yid steps forward, a fair skin slab, low and wide, with a lumpy forehead and a forked yellow beard.
I suggest you return to your vehicle, officer, he says softly, reasonably. And go on while you're going.
Lanceman grins.
Is that what you suggest? He says.
The other street corner men step forward now, filling in the space all around the bruiser with the lightning beard. There must be 20 of them, more than Lanceman believed at first. Lanceman's glow gutters, flickers like a light bulb going bad.
I'll put it another way, says the blonde bruiser, a bulge at his hip drawing the attention of his fingers.
Get back in the car.
Lanceman pulls at his chin. Madness, he thinks. Chasing a theoretical lead in a non-existent case, you lose your temper for no reason. The next thing you know, you have caused an incident among a branch of black hats with clout, money, and a stockpile of Manchurian and surplus Russian firearms recently estimated by police intelligence, in a confidential report, to be adequate to the needs of a guerrilla insurgency in a small Central American republic.
Madness. The reliable madness of Lanceman. How about you come over here and make me? Lonsman says.
That's when Berko opens his door and displays his ancestral bare bulk in the street. His profile is regal, worthy of a coin or a carved mountainside, and he carries in his right hand the uncanniest hammer any Jew or Gentile is ever likely to see. It's a replica of the one that Chief Catlion is reported to have swung during the Russian-Tlingit War of 1804, which the Russians lost. Berko fashioned it for the purpose of intimidating Yids when he was 13 and new to their labyrinth, and it has not failed its purpose yet, which is why Berko keeps it in the back seat of Lonsman's car. The head is a 35-pound block of meteorite iron that Hertz Shemitz dug up at an old Russian site near Yakovy. The handle was carved with a Sears hunting knife from a 40-ounce baseball bat. Interlocking black ravens and Red Sea monsters writhe along the shaft, grinning big-toothed grins. Their pigmentation used up 14 flare pens. A pair of raven feathers dangles on a leather thong from the top of the shaft. This detail may not be historically accurate, but it works on the Yiddish mind to savage effect, saying, Indianer. The word gets handed up and down the stalls and storefronts. Sitka Jews rarely see or speak to Indians, except in federal court or in the small Jewish towns along the line. It takes very little imagination for these verbivers to picture Berko and his hammer engaged in the wholesale spattering of pale-faced brain pans. Then they catch sight of Berko's yarmulke and a flutter of fine white fringe at his waist from his ritual four-corner, and you can feel all that giddy xenophobia drain off the crowd, leaving a residue of racist vertigo. That's how it goes for Berko Shemitz in the district of Sitka when he breaks out the hammer and goes Indian. 50 years of movie scalpings and whistling arrows and burning Conestogas have their effect on people's minds, and then sheer incongruity does the rest. Berko Shemitz, says the man with the forked beard, blinking as big, slow feathers of snow begin to fall on his shoulders and hat. What's up, Yid?
Dovid Sussman, Berko says, lowering the hammer. I thought it was you.
Onto his cousin he trains his big minotaur eyes, full of long-suffering and reproach. It was not Berko's idea to come to Verbov Island. It was not Berko's idea to pursue the Lasker case after they had been told to lay off. It was not Berko's idea to flee in shame to a cheap Unterstadt flophouse where mystery junkies get capped by the goddess of chess. A sweet Sabbath to you, Sussman, Berko says, tossing the hammer into the back of Lonsman's car. When it hits the floor, the springs inside the bucket seats ring like bells. A sweet Sabbath to you, too, Detective, Sussman says. The other Yids echo the greeting a bit unsure. Then they turn away and resume their back and forth over a fine point of pot koshering or vin erasure. When they get in the car, Berko slams the door and says, I hate doing that. They drive down Avenue 225, and every face turns to look at the Indian Jew in the blue Chevrolet. So much for asking a few discreet questions, Berko says bitterly. One day, Myers, to help me, I'm going to use my head knocker on you. Maybe you should, Lonsman says. Maybe I would welcome it as therapy. They crawl west on Avenue 225 toward the shop of Itzhak Zimbalist. Courts and cul-de-sacs, single-family neo-Ukrainians and condominium units, steep-roofed clabbered structures painted somber colors and built right out to the property lines. The houses jostle and shoulder one another the way black hats do in synagogue. Not a single for sale sign, Lonsman observes. Laundry on every line. All the other sects have been packing up the Torahs and the hat boxes. The Harkavis have a ghost town, but not the Verbivers. Either they're totally oblivious to reversion, or they know something we don't.
They're Verbivers, Berko says. Which way would you bet?
You're saying the Rebbe put the fix in. Green cards for everyone. Lonsman considers this possibility. He knows, of course, that a criminal organization like the Verbiver Ring can't flourish without the ready services of bagmen and secret lobbyists, without regular applications of Greece and body English to the works of government. The Verbivers, with their Talmudic grasp of systems, their deep pockets, and the impenetrable face they present to the outer world, have broken or rigged many mechanisms of control. But to have figured a way to gaff the entire INS like a Coke machine with a dollar on a string? Nobody has that much weight, Lonsman says. Not even the verb of a Rebbe. Berko ducks his head and gives his shoulders a half shrug, as if he doesn't want to say anything more lest terrible forces be unleashed. Scourges and plagues and holy tornadoes.
Just because you don't believe in miracles, he says.
13. Zimbalist, the boundary maven, that learned old fart, he's ready when a rumor of Indians and a blue hunk of Michigan muscle comes rumbling up to his front door. Zimbalist's shop is a stone building with a zinc roof and big doors on rollers, at the wide end of a cobbled plot. The plot starts narrow at one end and broadens out like the nose of a cartoon Jew. Half a dozen crooked lanes tumble into it, following paths first laid down by long-vanished Ukrainian goats or aurochs, past house fronts that are faithful copies of lost Ukrainian originals. A Disney shtetl, bright and clean as a freshly forged birth certificate. An artful jumble of mud-brown and mustard-yellow houses, wood and plaster with thatched roofs. Across from Zimbalist's shop, at the narrow end of the plots, stands the house of Heschel Spielman, 10th in the dynastic line from the original Rebbe of Verbov, himself a famous worker of miracles. 3 neat white cubes of spotless stucco, with mansard roofs of blue slate tile and tall windows, shuttered and narrow. An exact copy of the original home back in Verbov, of the present Rebbe's wife's grandfather, the 8th Verbov a Rebbe, right down to the nickel-plated bathtub in the upstairs washroom. Even before they turned to money laundering, smuggling, and graft, Verbova Rebbes distinguished themselves from the competition by the splendor of their waistcoats, the French silver on their Sabbath table, the soft Italian boots on their feet. The boundary maven is small, frail, slope-shouldered, call him 75, but looking 10 years older. Patchy cinder-gray hair worn too long, sunken dark eyes, and pale skin tinged yellow like a celery heart. He wears a zip cardigan with collar flaps and a pair of old plastic sandals, navy blue, over white socks with a hole for the left big toe and its horn. His herringbone trousers are stained with egg yolk, acid, tar, epoxy fixative, sealing wax, green paint, mastodon blood. The maven's face is bony, mostly nose and chin, evolved for noticing, probing, cutting straight to gaps, breaches, and lapses. His full ashy beard flutters in the wind like bird fluff caught in a barbed wire fence. In 100 years of helplessness, this would be the last face that Lantzman would ever turn to, hoping for aid or information. But Berko knows more about Black Hat life than Lantzman ever will. Standing next to Zimbalist, in front of the arched stone door of the shop, a beardless young bachelor holds an umbrella to keep the snow off the old fart's head. The black cake of the kid's hat is already dusted with a quarter inch of frosting. Zimbalist gives him the attention you give a tree in a pot. "You're fatter than ever," he says by way of greeting as Berko swaggers toward him, some ghost of the weight of the warhammer lingering in his gait. "Big as a sofa!" "Professor Zimbalist," Berko says, swinging that invisible mallet. "You look like something that fell out of a used vacuum cleaner bag." "8 years you don't bother me." "Yeah, I thought I'd give you a break." "That's nice." Too bad every other Jew in this accursed potato paring of a district kept right on banging me a kettle all day long. He turns to the bachelor with the umbrella. Tea? Glasses? Jam? The bachelor murmurs an Aramaic allusion to abject obedience quoted from the tractate on the hierarchy of dogs, cats, and mice, opens the door for the boundary maven, and they go in. It's one vast, echoing room, divided by theory into a garage, a workshop, and an office that's lined with steel map cabinets, framed testimonials, and all the black-spined volumes of the endless, bottomless law. The big rolling doors are there to let the vans go in and out. 3 vans, judging from the tray of oil stains on the smooth cement floor. Lantzman gets paid, and lives, to notice what normal people miss, but it seems to him that until he walked into Zimbalist, the boundary maven's shop, he hasn't given enough attention to string. String, twine, rope, cord, tape, filament, lanyard, hawser, and cable. Polypropylene, hemp, rubber, rubberized copper, Kevlar, steel, silk, flax, braided velvet. The boundary maven has vast stretches of the Talmud by heart. Topography, geography, geodesy, geometry, trigonometry, they're a reflex, like sighting along the barrel of a gun. But the boundary maven lives and dies by the quality of his string. Most of it, you can measure it in miles or in versts or in hands, like a boundary maven, is coiled neatly on spools hung from the wall or stacked neatly by size on metal spindles. But a lot of it is heaped here and there in crazes and tangles. Brambles, hair combings, huge thorny elf knots of string and wire, blowing around the shop like tumbleweeds. "This is my partner, Professor, Detective Lantzman," Berko says.
You want somebody to bang you a kettle, let me tell you. A pain in the ass like you? Don't get me started.
Lonsman and the professor shake hands. I know this one, the boundary maven says, coming in close to get a better look at Lonsman, giving him the squint eye as if he's one of the maven's 10,000 boundary maps.
That caught the maniac Podolsky. That sent Hyman Shani to prison.
Lonsman stiffens and shakes out the foil sheet of his blast shield, ready for an earful. Hyman Charney, a Verbiver dollar washer with a string of video stores, hired two Filipino schlossers, contract killers, to help him cement a tricky business deal. But Lonsman's best informer is Benito Taganas, the Filipino-style Chinese donut king. Benito's information led Lonsman to the roadhouse by the airfield, where the hapless schlossers were waiting for a plane, and their testimony put Charney away, despite the best efforts of the thickest courtroom Kevlar that Verbiver money could buy. Hyman Charney is still the only Verbiver ever to be convicted and sentenced on criminal charges in the district.
Look at him. Zimbalist's face breaks open at the bottom. His teeth are like the pipes of an organ made of bones. His laugh sounds like a handful of rusty forks and nail heads clattering on the ground. He thinks I give a shit about these people, may their loins be as withered as their souls. The maven stops laughing. What, you thought I was one of them?
It feels like the deadliest question Lonsman has ever been asked.
No, Professor, he says.
Lonsman also had some doubt that Zimbalist was really a professor, but there in the office, above the head of the bachelor struggling with the electric kettle, are the framed credentials and certificates from the Shiva of Warsaw, 1939, the Polish Free State, 1950, and Bronfman Manual and Technical, 1955. Also those testimonials, haskimos, and affidavits, each in its sober black frame, one from what looks to be every rabbi in the district, two-bit and big-time, from Yaakovy to Sitka. Lonsman makes a show of giving Zimbalist another once-over, but it's obvious just from the big yarmulke covering the eczema at the back of his skull, with its fancy embroidery of silver thread, that the boundary maven isn't a Verbiver.
I wouldn't make that mistake.
No?
What about marrying one of them like I did? Would you make that mistake?
When it comes to marriage, I like to let other people make the mistakes, Lonsman says. My ex-wife, for example.
Zimbalist waves them over, past the stout oak map table, to a couple of broken ladder-back chairs beside a massive roll-top desk. The bachelor can't get out of his way fast enough, and the boundary maven grabs him by the ear.
What are you doing?
He seizes the kid's hand.
Look at those fingernails. Feh!
He drops the hand as if it's a piece of bad fish.
Go. Get out of here. Get on the radio. Find out where those idiots are and what's taking so long.
He pours water into a pot and throws in a fistful of loose tea that looks suspiciously like shredded string.
One Erev they have to patrol. One! I have 12 men working for me. There's not a single one of them who couldn't get lost trying to find his foot fingers at the far end of his socks.
Lonsman has put a lot of work into the avoidance of having to understand concepts like that of the Erev, but he knows that it's a typical Jewish ritual dodge, a scam run on God, that controlling motherfucker. It has something to do with pretending that telephone poles are doorposts and that the wires are lintels. You can tie off an area using poles and strings and call it an Erev, then pretend on the Sabbath that this Erev you've drawn, in the case of Zimbalist and his crew, it's pretty much the whole district, is your house. That way you can get around the Sabbath ban on carrying in a public place and walk to shul with a couple of Alka-Seltzers in your pocket, and it isn't a sin. Given enough string and enough poles, and with a little creative use of existing walls, fences, cliffs, and rivers, you could tie a circle around pretty much any place and call it an Erev. But somebody has to lay down those lines, survey the territory, maintain the strings and the poles, and guard the integrity of the make-believe walls and doors against weather, vandalism, bears, and the telephone company. That's where the boundary maven comes in. He has the whole strings and poles market cornered. The Verbivers took him up first, and with their strong-arm tactics behind him, one by one the Satmar, Babov, Lubavitch, Gur, and all the other black hat sects have come to rely on his services and his expertise. When a question arises as to whether or not some particular stretch of sidewalk or lakefront or open field is contained within an Erev, Zimbalist, though not a rabbi, is the one to whom all the rabbis defer. On his maps and his crews and his spools of polypropylene baling twine depends the state of the souls of every pious Jew in the district. By some accounts, he's the most powerful yid in town, and that's why he's allowed to sit down behind his big oak desk with its 72 pigeonholes smack in the middle of Verbov Island and drink a glass of tea with the man who collared Hyman Charney. "What's the matter with you?" he says to Berko, easing himself with a rubbery squeak onto an inflatable donut cushion. He takes a package of Broadway's from a cigarette clip on his desk. "Why are you going around scaring everybody with that hammer of yours?" "My partner was disappointed by the welcome we received," Berko says. "It lacked that Sabbath glow," Lunsman says, lighting a papyrus of his own. "In my opinion." Zimbalist slides a three-corner copper ashtray across the desk. On the south side of the ashtray, it says Krasny's Tobacco and Stationery, which is where Isidore Lunsman used to go for his monthly copy of Chess Review. Krasny's, with its lending library and encyclopedic humidor and annual poetry prize, was crushed by American chain stores years ago, and at the sight of this homely ashtray, the squeeze box of Lonsman's heart gives a nostalgic wheeze. 2 years of my life I gave those people, Berko says. You'd think some of them could remember me. Am I that easy to forget? Let me tell you something, detective. With another squeak of the rubber donut, Zimbalist is up again and pouring tea into three filthy glasses. The way they breed around here, those people you saw on the street today aren't the ones you knew 8 years ago. Those are their grandchildren. Nowadays, they're born pregnant. He hands them each a steaming glass, too hot to hold. It scalds the tips of Lonsman's fingers. It smells like grass, rose hips, maybe a hint of string. They keep on making new Jews, Berko says, stirring a spoonful of jam into his glass. Nobody's making places to put them. That is the truth, Zimbalist says, as his bony ass hits the donut. He grimaces. Strange times to be a Jew. Not around here, apparently, says Lansman. Strictly life as usual in Verbov Island. A stolen BMW in every driveway and a talking chicken in every pot. These people don't worry until the Rebbe tells them to worry, Zimbalist says. Maybe they don't have anything to worry about, Berko says. Maybe the Rebbe already took care of the problem. I wouldn't know. I don't believe that for a second. So don't believe it. One of the garage doors goes sliding back on its wheels, and a white van pulls in, a bright mask of snow on its windshield. 4 men in yellow coveralls pile out of the van, their noses red, their beards tied up in black nets. They start blowing their noses and stamping their feet, and Zimbalist has to go over and yell at them for a while. It turns out there was a problem near the reservoir in Shalom Aleichem Park. Some idiot at Municipal put up a handball wall right smack in the middle of a make-believe doorway between 2 light poles. They all tramp over to the map table in the middle of the office. While Zimbalist gets down the appropriate chart and enrolls it, the crew members take turns nodding and flexing their scowling muscles at Lonsman and Berko. After that, the crew just ignores them. They say the Maven is a string map for every city where 10 Jewish men ever bumped noses, Berko says to Lonsman. Clear on back to Jericho. I started that rumor myself, Zimbalist says, keeping his eyes on the chart. He tracks down the site, and one of the boys sketches in the handball wall with the stub of a pencil. Zimbalist quickly plots out a workaround that will hold through sundown tomorrow, a salient in the great imaginary wall of the Erev. He sends his boys back down to the Harkavy to run some plastic pipe up the sides of a couple of nearby phone poles so that the Satmars who live on the east side of Shalom Aleichem Park can take their dogs out for a walk without endangering their souls. I'm sorry, he says, coming back around the desk. He winces. I don't enjoy the act of sitting anymore. Now, what can I do for you? I doubt very much that you came here with a question about Reshus Harabim. We're working a homicide, Professor Zimbalist, Lonsman says. And we have reason to believe the deceased may have been a Verbover, or had ties to the Verbovers, at least at one time. Ties, the Maven says, giving them a glimpse of those pipe organ stalactites of his. I suppose I know something about those. He was living in a hotel on Max Nordau Street under the name of Emanuel Lasker. Lasker? Like the chess player? There's a crease in the parchment of Zimbalist's yellow forehead, and deep in the eye sockets, a scrape of flint and steel. Surprise, puzzlement, a memory kindling. I used to follow the game, he explains. A long time ago. So did I, Lonsman says. So did our dead guy, right up to the end. Next to the body, there was a game all set up. He was reading Siegbert Tarrasch, and he was familiar to the regulars at the Einstein Chess Club. They knew him as Frank. Frank, the boundary maven says, giving it a Yankee twang. Frank, Frank, Frank. That was his first name? It's a common Jewish last name, but a first name, no. You know for a fact he was a Jew, this Frank? Berko and Lanzmann exchange a quick look. They don't know anything for sure. The phylacteries in the nightstand could have been a plant or a memento, something left behind by a prior occupant of room 208. Nobody at the Einstein Club claimed to have seen Frank the dead junkie in shul, rocking in the grip of the standing prayer. We have reason to believe, Berko repeats calmly, that he may at one time have been a Verbiver Jew. What kind of reason? There were a couple of likely telephone poles, Lanzmann says. We tied a string between them. He reaches into his pocket and takes out an envelope. He passes one of Springer's death Polaroids across the desk to Zimbalist, who holds it at arm's length, long enough to form the idea that it's a picture of a corpse. He takes a deep breath and purses his lips, getting ready to lay on them a solid professional consideration of the evidence at hand. A picture of a dead man, it's a break, to be honest, in the routine of a boundary maven's life. Then he looks at the picture, and in the instant before he regains absolute control of his features, Lanzmann sees Zimbalist take a swift punch in the belly. The wind departs his lungs, and the blood drains from his face. In his eyes, the steady maven flicker of intelligence is snuffed out. For a second, Lanzmann is looking at a Polaroid of a dead boundary maven. Then the lights come back on in the old fart's face. Berko and Lanzmann wait a little, and then a little more, and Lanzmann understands that the boundary maven is fighting as hard as he can to maintain that control, to hold on to the chance of making his next words. Detectives, I have never seen that man before in my life, and having it sound plausible, inevitable, true. Who was he, Professor Zimbalist? Berko says at last. Zimbalist sets the photograph down on the desk and looks at it some more, not bothering about what his eyes or his lips might be doing. "Oy, that boy," he says. "That sweet, sweet boy." He takes a handkerchief from the pocket of his zippered cardigan and blots the tears from his cheeks and barks once. It's a horrible sound. Lanzmann picks up the maven's glass of tea and pours it into his own. From his hip pocket, he takes the bottle of vodka he impounded in the men's room of the Vorsch that morning. He pours two fingers into the glass of tea and then holds the cup out to the old fart. Zimbalist takes the vodka without a word and knocks it down in one shot. Then he returns the handkerchief to its pocket and gives Lanzmann his photograph. "I taught that boy to play chess," he says. "When that man was a boy, I mean. Before he grew up. I'm sorry, I'm not making sense." He goes for another Broadway, but he's already smoked them all. It takes him a while to figure this out. He sits there poking around in the foil with a hooked finger as if he's going for the peanut and a package of Cracker Jack. Lanzmann fixes him up with a smoke. "Thanks, Lanzmann, thank you." But then he doesn't say anything. He just sits there watching the pyros burn down. He peers out from his cavernous eye holes at Berko, then steals a card player peek at Lanzmann. He's recovering from the shock now, trying to map the situation, the lines he cannot cross, the doorways that he mustn't step through on peril of his soul. The hairy, mottled crab of his hand flicks one of its legs toward the telephone on his desk. In another minute, the truth and darkness of life will once again have been remanded to the custody of lawyers. The garage door creaks and rumbles, and with a moan of gratitude, Zimbalist starts to pop up again. But this time Berko beats him to his feet. He drops a heavy hand on the old man's shoulder.
"Sit down, Professor," he says. "I beg you. Take it slow if you have to, but please, sit your ass down on that donut."
He leaves the hand where it is, giving Zimbalist a gentle squeeze, and nods toward the garage.
"Meyer."
Lanzmann crosses the workshop to the garage and hauls out his shield. He walks directly into the path of the van, as if the shield really is a badge that can stop a 2-ton Chevy. The driver hits the brakes, and the howl of tires echoes against the cold stone walls of the garage. The driver rolls down his window. He has the full Zimbalist crew equipage. Beard in a net, yellow coverall, well-developed scowl. "What gives, detective?" he wants to know. "Go take a drive," Lanzmann says. "We're talking." He reaches over to the dispatch panel and grabs hold of the skulking bachelor by the collar of his long coat, dangles the kid like a puppy around to the passenger side of the van, and drags open the side door, then tenderly shoves the bachelor into the van. "And take this little pisher with you." "Boss!" the driver calls over to the boundary maven.
After a moment, Zimbalist nods and waves the driver away. "But where should I go?" the driver says to Lantzman. "I don't know," Lantzman says. He drags the van's door shut and shoves it home. "Go buy me a nice present." Lantzman pounds on the hood of the van, and it rolls back out into the storm of white lines being knit like strings of the boundary maven across the replica house fronts and the blazing gray sky. Lantzman pulls the garage door into place and throws the latch. "No, how about you start over?" he says to Zimbalist when he sits down again in the ladder back chair. He crosses his legs and lights another papyrus for each of them. "We have plenty of time." "Come on, Professor," Berko says. "You know the victim since he's a boy, right? All those memories have got to be going around and around in your head right now. As bad as you feel, it's going to feel better if you just start talking." "It isn't that," the boundary maven says. It isn't that." He takes the lit papyrus from Lantzman, and this time he smokes most of it before he starts to talk. He is a learned Yid, and he likes to have his thoughts in order. "His name is Menachem," he begins. "Mendel. He is, or was, 38, a year older than you, Detective Shemitz, but he had the same birthday, August 15th, isn't that right, eh?" "I thought so." "You see? This is the map cabinet." He taps his hairless dome. "Maps of Jericho, Detective Shemitz. Jericho and Tyre." Tapping the map cabinet gets a little out of control, and he knocks the yarmulke off his head. When he grabs at it, ash cascades all down his sweater. "Mendel's IQ was measured at 170, he continues. "By the time he was 8 or 9, he could read Hebrew, Aramaic, Judeo-Spanish, Latin, Greek, the most difficult texts, the thorniest tangles of logic and argument. By then, Mendel was already a much better chess player than I could ever hope to be. He had a remarkable memory for recorded games. He had only to read a transcript once, and after that he could reproduce it on a board or in his head, move by move, without a mistake. When he was older and they didn't let him play so much anymore, he would work through famous games in his head. He must have known 300-400 games by heart." "That's what they used to say about Melech Geistig," Lantzman says. "He had that kind of mind for the game." "Melech Geistig," Zimbalist says. "Geistig was a freak. It was not human, the way Geistig played. He had a mind like some kind of bug. The only thing he knew to do was eat you. He was rude, filthy, mean. Mendel wasn't like that at all. He made toys for his sisters, dolls out of clothespins and felt, a house from a box of oatmeal. Always glue on his fingers, a clothespin in his pocket with a face on it. I would give him twine for the hair. 8 little sisters hanging off him all the time. A pet duck that used to follow him around like a dog." Zimbalist's thin brown lips hitch themselves up at the corners. "Believe it or not, I once arranged for our match to be played between Mendel and Melech Geistig. You could do such things. Geistig was always broken in debt, and he would have played against a half-drunk bear if the money was right. The boy was 12 at the time. Geistig, 26. It was the year before he won the championship at Petersburg. They played 3 games in the back of my shop, which at that time, you remember, Detective, was on Ringelblum Avenue. I offered Geistig $5,000 to play against Mendel. The boy won the first and the third. The second game, he had black and played Geistig to a draw. Yes, Geistig was only too happy to keep the match a secret." "Why?" Lantzman wants to know. "Why did the games have to be kept secret?" "Because this boy," the boundary maven says, "the one who died in a hotel room on Max Nordau Street? Not a nice hotel, I imagine. A flea bag," Lantzman says. "He was shooting heroin into his arm." Lantzman nods, and after a hard second or two, Zimbalist nods too. "Yes, of course. No? The reason why I was obliged to arrange the games in secret was that this boy had been forbidden to play chess with outsiders. Somehow or other, I never learned how, Mendel's father got wind of the match against Geistig. It was a near thing for me. In spite of the fact that my wife was a relative of the father, I almost lost his haskama, which at that time was the foundation of my business. I built this whole operation on that endorsement."
"The father? You're not saying—" "It was Heschel Spillman," Berko says. "The man there in the picture is the son of the Verbova Rebbe."
Lantzman notices how quiet it is on Verbova Island, in the snow, inside a stone barn, with dark coming on as the profane week and the world that profaned it prepare to be plunged into the flame of 2 matched candles.
"That's right," Zimbalist says at last.
Mendel Spillman, the only son. He had a twin brother who was born dead. Later, that was interpreted as a sign. Lantzman says, a sign of what? That he would be a prodigy? That he would turn out to be a junkie living in a cheap Unterstadt flop? Not that, says Embolist. That nobody imagined. They said, they used to say, Berko begins. He screws up his face as if he knows what he'll say next is going to irk Lantzman or give him cause for scorn. He unscrews his brown eyes, lets it pass. He can't bring himself to repeat it. Mendel Spillman, dear God, I heard some stories. A lot of stories, Imbalist says. Nothing but stories till he was 20 years old. What kind of stories? Lantzman says, duly irked. Stories about what? Tell me already, damn you. So Zimbalist tells them a Mendel story. A certain woman, he says, was dying of cancer at Sitka General Hospital. A woman of his acquaintance, call her. This was back in 1973. The woman was twice a widow, her first husband a gambler shot by Starkers in Germany before the war. Her second, a string monkey in Zimbalist's employ who got tangled in a live power line. It was through supporting the widow of his dead worker with cash and favors that Zimbalist got to know her. It's not impossible that they fell in love. They were both past the age of foolish passion, so they were passionate without being fools. She was a dark, lean woman, already in the habit of controlling her appetites. They kept their affairs secret from everyone, not least Mrs. Zimbalist. To visit his lady friend in the hospital when she took ill, Zimbalist resorted to subterfuge, stealth, and the bribing of orderlies. He slept on a towel on the floor of the ward, curled between her bed and the wall. In the half-dark, when his mistress called out from the distances of morphine, he would spill water between her cracked lips and cool her forehead with a damp cloth. The clock on the hospital wall hummed to itself, got antsy, kept snapping off pieces of the night with its minute hand. In the morning, Zimbalist would creep back to his shop on Ringelblum Avenue. He told his wife he was sleeping there because his snoring was so bad, and wait for the boy. Almost every morning after worship and study, Mendel Spillman would come and play chess. Chess was permitted, even though the verb of a rabbinate and the larger community of the pious viewed as a waste of the boy's time. The older Mendel got, the more dazzling his feats of scholarship, the brighter his reputation for acumen beyond his years, the more painful this waste appeared. It was not just Mendel's memory, the agile reasoning, the grasp of precedent, history, law. No, even as a kid, Mendel Spillman seemed to intuit the messy human flow that both powered the law and required its elaborate system of drains and sluices. Fear, doubt, lust, dishonesty, broken vows, murder and love, uncertainty about the intentions of God and men. Little Mendel saw all of that, not only in the Aramaic abstract, but when it appeared in his father's study, clothed in the dark serge and juicy mother tongue of everyday life. If conflicts ever arose in the boy's mind, doubts about the relevance of the law that he was learning in the verb of a court at the feet of a bunch of king-sized gonoffs and crooks, they never showed. Not when he was a kid who believed, and not when the day came that he turned his back on it all. He had the kind of mind that could hold and consider contradictory propositions without losing its balance. It was because the Spillmans were so proud of his excellence as a Jewish son and scholar that they tolerated the side of Mendel's character that loved only to play. Mendel was always getting up elaborate pranks and hoaxes, staging plays that featured his sisters, his aunts, the duck. Some people thought the greatest miracle Mendel ever performed was to persuade his formidable father, year after year, to take the part of Queen Vashti in the Purim Spiel. The sight of that somber emperor, that mountain of dignity, that fearsome bulk mincing around in high-heeled shoes, a blonde wig, lipstick and rouge, bangles and spangles, it might have been the most horrible feat of female impersonation jewelry ever produced. People loved it, and they loved Mendel for making it happen each year.